Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
While no one knows what tomorrow may bring, Bridgestone is working toward a more positive outlook. With innovations like developing a tire using 75% recycled and renewable materials. It's just one of the many ways Bridgestone is making a difference today for generations to come. Because that's what really matters. Bridgestone, solutions for your journey. Visit whatreallymatters.com to learn more.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What is up? Welcome to the Los Angeles Dodgers podcast on the Believe Network. I am JP Hornstra of the Southern California News Group. The Dodgers said goodbye to two of their former stars on Friday, Justin Turner and Trevor Bauer. Two different players, two very different kinds of farewell messages. Quote, leader, all-star, World Series champion, Roberto Clemente Award winner. Your time in LA was so impactful that a day was named after you. Thank you for everything you've done for the team, for the fans, and the city. You will be missed. Best of luck in Boston. End quote. That was, in case you couldn't guess, the message to Justin Turner that was posted to the Dodgers' official social media accounts, along with a big thank you superimposed over a picture of Turner. Now, here's the statement posted to the team's official social media accounts regarding Bauer. No photos, no thank yous, just the words this time. Quote, the Dodgers organization believes that allegations of sexual assault or domestic violence should be thoroughly investigated with due process given to the accused. From the beginning, we have fully cooperated with Major League Baseball's investigation and strictly followed the process stipulated under MLB's Joint Domestic Violence, Sexual Assault, and Child Abuse Policy. Two extensive reviews of all the available evidence in this case, one by Commissioner Manfred and another by a neutral arbitrator, concluded that Mr. Bauer's actions warranted the longest ever active player suspension in our sport for violations of this policy. Now that this process has been completed, and after careful consideration, we have decided that he will no longer be part of our organization. It is impossible to conceive of two more diametrically opposed ways to say goodbye to two players on the same day. This had to strike you if you were paying even remote attention to what was happening with these two players. I think we all had a pretty good idea what the reaction would be to Justin Turner leaving. A gushing tribute video from the team, verbal pats on the back from former teammates on social media. None of that came as a surprise. I'll have Sean Green on this episode later to talk about Turner and the Dodgers' other offseason moves to this point in the winter. So stay tuned for that. Sean and I did not talk about Trevor Bauer because when we recorded it, the decision had yet to be made official for some reason. The decision itself was obvious and predictable enough that I think discussing the possibility of letting him pitch in 23 was off the table. We weren't going to talk about that. But a number of people asked out loud in emails to myself, social media, perhaps privately, can you imagine the reaction if Trevor Bauer comes back? Clearly, the Dodgers executive team wondered the reaction if he ever came back, and they wanted no part of that. I had a little bit harder time imagining the reaction to what they ultimately did by designating Bauer for assignment. Because, number one, the Dodgers had been eerily silent about this ever since that first temporary restraining order against Bauer was issued back in July of 2021, which feels like a really long time ago. Like the statement said, they had to abide by the protocols of the Joint Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Policy. We didn't know when they were allowed to speak exactly what language the team would use to tell Trevor Bauer goodbye. Would they let the DFA speak for itself? Would they say something independent of Major League Baseball? I doubted there would be a press conference, but if you're in my position, you're wondering if there's going to be time for questions. Number two, Bauer's teammates had been silent, or at least very guarded, since this process began. Last April, of course, Bauer was handed a 2-year domestic violence suspension. At the time, I got an extremely short comment from Austin Barnes about that. The exact quote was, quote, "We don't know what's going on. Just kind of focus on who's in here is probably a good idea." To my knowledge, nobody else in the clubhouse said anything on the record that day. And no one else who played with Bauer in Los Angeles has said anything on the record between then and now. That's always struck me as odd about this whole situation. I understand what a gag order is. It's when a team's PR staff instructs players not to comment on something. I think a lot of that was going on here. But Trevor Bauer is not part of the Dodgers now. He hasn't been all weekend, and I haven't heard anything. I also understand that Trevor Bauer is perhaps the most litigious active professional athlete of our time. And any public shows of support can and will be used as evidence in a court of law. I understand if you're a teammate or an ex-teammate not wanting any part of that. But let's put Bauer's penalty in context. There has been, at any given time since he signed with the Dodgers, a vocal group of fans willing to support him in spite of basically any questionable behavior. Bauer was unapologetic at his introductory press conference when we asked him about some of the things that we knew were in his past, like his harassment of women online. Didn't apologize for that. He was unapologetic about the circumstances that led to the temporary restraining order, and in response to the two women from Ohio who subsequently accused him of similar behavior. Some fans really like that attitude. Now, not only has Bauer maintained his innocence against the sexual assault allegations, he has sued one of his accusers for defamation, effectively calling himself the victim. Look, I like to give people the doubt until I can't anymore. Trevor Bauer, or at least his legal team, did a good enough job creating reasonable doubt around that woman's allegation that no criminal charges were ever brought against him. But if all these cases are so black and white, where is the public support from the people who know Trevor Bauer? I'm not talking about his fake friends on Twitter. I'm not talking about his agents. I'm not talking about his legal team. I'm not talking about the employees of his video production company. Bauer has very much stood alone publicly amid all of this. Now, privately, I know there are players in the Dodgers clubhouse who supported him at least at certain points of time when I heard them speak. I also know that long before Bauer became a Dodger, he had a reputation as a teammate. And some, perhaps many, of his peers were not fans. That was before any of the three women came forward publicly to accuse him of assault. On Friday, when the Dodgers made this announcement that Bauer was going to be designated for assignment, Bruzdar Graterol, Dodgers pitcher, Jacob Amaya, Dodgers shortstop, three other Dodgers minor league players, and the wife of a major league player all hit like on that social media Instagram post announcing that Bauer had been designated for assignment. Make of that what you will. But let's forget about teammates or their wives for a second. I can see why fans might not want to engage with this story at all, because it necessarily requires that we learn things about a professional athlete's sex life that a lot of people probably don't want to engage with. And certainly the Dodgers did not want to have the dual task of selling their fans on a family atmosphere at the ballpark, while also publicly defending an employee who had served the longest penalty MLB has ever assessed for domestic violence and sexual assault. For the team, that's probably what this calculus came down to. Again, I'm not sure why they took the full time to announce that Bauer would be designated for assignment. I can speculate, but that's a pretty obvious choice in my mind. Whatever help Bauer could offer the Dodgers starting rotation in 2023 was offset by the burden of hypocrisy on the players, on the PR staff, certainly on Bauer himself. I just don't think Bauer feels that burden. I'm not sure what he feels, because he's been so slow to apologize and so quick to litigate. I didn't know how the exchange of statements on Friday would go down. Maybe that's why the Dodgers took their time crafting that statement, because they knew that it could be used against them in a court of law. We knew there was no way Bauer was coming back, but how would each side handle their exit strategy? The Dodgers issued their statement at 4:21 Friday afternoon. That's when it hit my inbox. A bit later, Bauer issued his statement, quote, "While we were unable to communicate throughout the administrative leave and arbitration process, my representative spoke to Dodgers leadership immediately following the arbitration decision. Following 2 weeks of conversations around my return to the organization, I sat down with Dodgers leadership in Arizona yesterday, who told me that they wanted me to return and pitch for the team this year. While I am disappointed by the organization's decision today, I appreciate the wealth of support I've received from the Dodgers clubhouse. I wish the players all the best and look forward to competing elsewhere." And there it is, that little parting shot. "I sat down with leadership yesterday who told me they wanted me to return and pitch for the team this year." Always litigating the facts, that Bauer. USA Today's Bob Nightingale had the details on that. I'm just going to read from his story. Quote, "Dodgers executives flew to Phoenix on Thursday," this is last Thursday, "to meet privately with Bauer to decide if he deserved another chance. The Dodgers decided it was worth finding out whether he deserved any consideration of remaining in the organization. It was the first time the Dodgers had spoken to Bauer in the 18 months since he was placed on administrative leave on July 2nd, 2021. Dodger officials declined to go into details of their conversation, but privately revealed that they didn't hear any remorse, apologies, or anything in the slightest from Bauer to change their mind. They reconvened in Los Angeles and decided Friday that Bauer would never again put on a Dodger uniform." If you've read any of my writing, you know I like to lean into the gray areas of situations. You know I like to avoid the sappy black and white tales of good versus evil. In this case, I keep coming back to the Dodgers' two farewell messages, the one to Justin Turner and the one for Trevor Bauer. Justin Turner went out of his way for 9 years to make sure the Dodgers never looked bad by virtue of anything he said or did. Trevor Bauer might not have committed a crime in the eyes of the law. It's hard to say without a trial. But he chose to litigate the intimate details of his defense against three different sexual assault accusers, not only in court, but on social media, in public. And that made the Dodgers look bad. If Trevor Bauer can't acknowledge that, I struggle to imagine someone so intelligent lacking any semblance of self-awareness. That's all I really want to say about that. The Dodgers are still on the hook for about $22.5 million of Bauer's 2023 salary. There's really no way to spin that that looks good for the Dodgers. It's bad. It was a bad decision to sign him. I don't think that's all that a hot of a take. Bauer's 2023 salary for luxury tax calculation purposes is even larger than $22.5 million. And this is the year the Dodgers wanted to be under the luxury tax threshold? Well, that hurts. But what are you going to do? You're going to go back in time and not sign Bauer in the first place? Cool, let's fire up the DeLorean. Anyway, enough about him. Let's get into some off-season transaction talk. Turner, J.D. Martinez, Noah Syndergaard, keeping up with the Padres. And to do that, I'll bring back Sean Green.
Sean, thanks for hopping back on the pod.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. It's been a rainy New Year so far. And other than that, I really can't say much about it because it's still new. but what we can say is also very new is a sizable portion of the Dodgers roster. A lot of changes since we last spoke. Noah Syndergaard and J.D. Martinez have signed one-year contracts, and the Dodgers have said farewell to Justin Turner, Andrew Heaney, and Craig Kimbrell. I guess let's start with Justin Turner because he's a guy who we've seen a lot of over the last, decade, really, in a Dodgers uniform, and it's just going to be weird seeing him as a member of the Boston Red Sox. I don't know how that'll be for you, but, you know, on a practical level, you talk about somebody who's had a lot of impact on and off the field. How much of a difference do you think it will make not having Justin Turner on the Dodgers roster in 2023?
Yeah, I'm sad to see him go. I think it'll actually have a pretty significant impact. Both on the field and in the clubhouse, probably even more so. He's kind of the heartbeat of the Dodgers. He's been through all of the more ups than downs, but he's been through a lot over the last 10 or so years. And, you know, the fans love him. He's got a lot of character, a lot of heart. And, you know, that's something about the game that's kind of changed, I think. I mean, maybe the earlier part of my first half of my career is, you know, guys move on more than they did in the past. You know, I remember, you know, a guy like Paul O'Neill comes to the Yankees kind of in a similar way that Justin Turner did, except he was, Justin was more of a bench player, but Paul O'Neill was, you know, a solid player in Cincinnati, comes to the Yankees, and like, there's no thought of him going elsewhere. And I think it's, you know, just because of the nature of the game and, you know, the fact that players are a little bit more interchangeable pieces. I think it's sad as a fan to see someone that means so much to the organization go. On the flip side, you know, Kershaw's staying, so I mean, that could have easily gone the other way as well.
Sure.
He ended up in Texas. But I think, you know, to have a guy like that leave is, you know, it's a bummer.
Yeah. It's an interesting comp with O'Neill because I know the Yankees recently retired his uniform number, and somebody who was, well, in high school for part of his Yankees career and then covering baseball on the West Coast toward the end of it, that kind of struck me as a little bit odd because from a distance, like you think about Paul O'Neill compared to the on-field accomplishments of the other players who the Yankees have retired their number, like, okay, what's going on here? But you know, you talk about the guy that he was off the field and then the impact he had on his teammates. That makes a ton of sense. I guess the one thing that I would wonder about, too, I think about when Justin Turner kind of became that guy in the Dodgers clubhouse, he really inherited that role from AJ Ellis. And I was kind of surprised when the Dodgers traded him because he was really that clubhouse leader guy. And AJ even said on the day that he was traded, like, you know, Justin Turner is going to be the next leader of this team. And I don't know if you can add some context to this, Sean, but like, is there a sense within the clubhouse among players when that torch passes where you know that you have somebody who can step into that leadership role, even if it isn't obvious from the outside of the team?
Yeah. And sometimes it's perceived leadership and just respect. So there's different types of, I think, articles of clothing that someone like Justin Turner wore, like he, different hats, whatever you want, however you want to phrase it. But, you know, he was definitely a leader, vocal leader amongst the players, but he was also that fan kind of leader, like the guy that represents the beard and everything kind of represented that era of Dodger baseball. And so I think there's just different, there's different vantage points of that leadership. When I was in Toronto, we had the change in the guard really for us was from 97 to 98. Well, one, Cito Gaston was the manager, and he was let go at the end of 97. We had a new manager coming in, but like Joe Carter and kind of the last like really focal points of the World Championship teams left after 97, or, you know, each year it seemed like, you know, Robbie Alomar left after 95 and, you know, Ed Sprague and other guys. You know, so it's like, it was slowly happening, but 97 was kind of the transfer of power. And all of a sudden we were a young team with, you know, it was really like Carlos Delgado, myself, Alex Gonzalez, like we kind of the young core that came up as Blue Jays took over. And it was a good transition and it worked out really well. It was kind of a younger energy and scrappier mentality. And the Dodgers have so many players that have had so much success, you know, whether it's someone like Freddie Freeman who came over there, Max Muncy, who's been there for the, you know, the peak stretch of the Dodgers success. So there's different players there that could easily step in, and there's no shortage of superstars. So I don't think it's going to be, you know, all of a sudden they're like a lost organization. I mean, they're still, you know, the Dodgers and the class of baseball, but it's definitely going to be, I think, a big shift seeing JT leave.
Yeah. And fortunately he won't be in the NL West. He'll basically be as far as away as you can get from the NL West. We had to see him a bunch of times in 2023 wearing that Red Sox uniform. That would be a little bit different. But, you know, speaking of the Red Sox, it was coincidental somewhat that the Dodgers brought in JD Martinez, who will, I think, in effect, be the primary DH in 2023, which Justin Turner probably would have been in 2023 had he re-signed. And when I think about the two of them, they're actually similar in a lot of ways in that, you know, they came up really not necessarily expecting to be the players that they became, but they changed their swings. They put in some extra work. They made these mid-career adjustments and became two of the better hitters in baseball, at least in their prime. And from what you know about JD Martinez, I know he's coming off of somewhat of a down year by his standards in Boston, but I think on the field, at least, that's probably no worse than a lateral move. I don't know. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I agree. I think if I would rather have, I'd rather be the Dodgers getting JD here than the Red Sox getting JT from the perspective of, I think they're both, they still have, you know, pop in their bats and still have the ability to put up good numbers. But I think the fact that JD played a long time in the NL West, there's, when you go to the other league, like JT's never played, I guess he played a little bit with Baltimore early on, but he doesn't really have the same comfort level. It's even weird things like what hotels you stay at, the same hotels and the restaurants you eat at, and getting, knowing how to get into the different ballparks, like the access points and all these little things. They sound kind of stupid, but when I first came to the Dodgers, that first year, it was my sixth season in the big leagues, I felt like a rookie again in some aspects because I didn't know anything. I was like, hey, will you go with me in a cab to get to stadiums? I don't know how to get in. I don't know who the clubhouse guy is. And so all this type of first time experience is kind of weird. So I think for JD, come in the Dodgers, he's going to fall back into those old memories and patterns of when he played for the Diamondbacks. And I think that's an advantage to come back, even though the pitchers are different. The teams are all very different. The managers are often different. He's still going to have that familiarity. And I think that's an advantage.
J.D. Martinez played only 62 games for the Diamondbacks in 2017, but I'll never forget it because that was enough for him to actually finish 14th in National League MVP voting. He just had that much of an impact on a pretty good Diamondbacks team that year that I can't quibble with some people who put him at the back of their ballot. I mean, that was peak J.D. Martinez. He hit 302 there and hit 29 homers in 62 games. So not only is he familiar with the NL West, but he did pretty good the last time he was in a
National League uniform. As you were talking about that, I was thinking he was there longer. I thought he was there after because he had such an impact on that Diamondbacks team. But you're right. Yeah, it was pretty brief. So, maybe there is going to be a little bit more of a learning curve. I don't know, but, clearly it wasn't an issue for him before. And he's at that age where you have both guys, you have a rough stretch, a couple of weeks or a month. And, the media is quick to point out, he's getting old, he's over the hill, he's about to be down, like all that type of stuff happens really, really quickly when you're the ages that these players are. So that's another kind of challenge to constantly battle for the last few innings of your career, so to speak.
Yeah. Boston especially, they can be a little bit more critical than the average market, to say the least. I want to shift to Noah Syndergaard, who was a guy I saw a fair amount last season pitching for the Angels, and he was okay. He had still the ability to compete with what he had, even though his fastball wasn't quite where it was when he was peaking earlier in his career with the New York Mets. Noah Syndergaard was somebody that the Dodgers looked at last season's trade deadline. Ultimately, they opted to go with the pitchers that they had, but they revisited that idea here and signed him to a one-year deal. I think the big thing for me, Sean, is that he's going to be 2 years removed from his Tommy John surgery and last year, his first full year back. That first year, it never quite goes as well as year two, all other things being equal. And I don't know if Syndergaard's quote about everything the Dodgers touching turning to gold is as relevant as just his elbow being healthier. I don't know. What's your take on Syndergaard joining the Dodgers rotation?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Having that extra year away from the Tommy John, I think that'll be good. I think if I'm the Dodgers, my perspective on that is, we have some really good starters and, we're not as deep as we were in the past, but we still have, Bobby Miller sitting there in either AAA or maybe even big leagues if he has a great spring or someone gets hurt or something. So, if I'm the Dodgers, I'm thinking, okay, I want this guy to give us innings, to go out there and get through the lineup twice, which is really their philosophy for the most part, and hand the ball over to a solid bullpen. So, is he a kind of guy that could do that with the stuff he has even was now or even last year? And I think the answer is yes. Do they need him to come out and be a number two or three? No, but if he could be a really solid back of the rotation pitcher and just go out there and compete, then, that's what they're wanting. If he could do more than that, then it's a home run. And they've shown before that they are able to bring guys in and have them move from that give us innings kind of guy to a, guys pitching an all-star game. And that's the ultimate, but I don't think you can't have that happen every time, every year where you bring someone in and they completely resurrect their careers.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the bullpen there. I think Dodger fans probably took it for granted that the past two seasons, their closers have been guys who ranked number one and number two among all active pitchers in saves. Talking about Craig Kimbrell and Kenley Jansen. Both of them have signed contracts for 2023, so they're off the board. The Dodgers will have a less established closer next season, whoever he is, that much we know, than whoever it was, at least at the beginning of last year. Daniel Hudson's in camp. If he's healthy, he's got a chance to be somebody who could fill that role, who has done it in the past. But more likely than not, most of the guys who are going to be vying for that haven't done it before. I don't know if that's going to be the Dodgers' plan, is to let guys compete for the ninth inning, or if they wind up making a trade, or I don't know. There just aren't that many established closers left on the free agent market. So it's January 5th as we sit here today, Sean. How big of a deal is that? And is that something the Dodgers, you think, will make a focal point of their last, 6 weeks before spring training begins?
I don't think they're going to make it a focal point. I think they'll, my guess is that they'll assess more in spring training and just let some guys compete. I hope that they go more with kind of locking someone into that role as opposed to doing the committee. But you know, there's different philosophies, and I just liked as a player having the confidence as you get to those last couple innings, knowing that you have a guy coming out that's, you know, that you believe in and that can handle that ninth inning. Cause I feel like it lines the rest of the bullpen up much, much better, but we'll see. I mean, they have some good arms out there, and you know, Eric Gagne stepped up in 2002. You know, he was not the closer coming into spring training. We didn't really have a closer. I think they were kind of leaning more towards Matt Hergis. Matt Hergis ended up getting traded during spring training for Guillermo Mota to Montreal, and Mota became a great setup guy for us, and Gagne was Eric Gagne, and that was, those 02, 03 were the best bullpens I've ever seen, and we didn't really have it all sorted out going to spring training. So there's definitely talent there, and if there's something lacking, and we know the Dodgers will go out and get what they need, whether it's, you know, during spring training or the first few months of the season.
Yeah, the other sort of trend that has come along with closers by committee is that sometimes I see the Braves do this a lot, actually, is they'll have a kid who is knocking on the door at the big leagues at AAA, but he's a starter at that level, and they'll bring him up as a reliever in you know, his first cup of coffee. And sometimes that goes so well that kid will be pitching the ninth inning, maybe not every day, but at some point. And part of me just wonders in the back of my mind if Bobby Miller isn't like the best option at the end of spring training. You know, Eric Gagne, you mentioned him. He was a starting pitcher at the big league level first, but if all things break, like, the Dodgers could go that route, and it might not necessarily be Miller. It might be Ryan Pepiot, who has a pretty good fastball changeup combination. It might be somebody who hasn't made a big league debut yet, or even somebody like, you know, Michael Grove, who has but hasn't really established himself. The Dodgers could get creative in that way. I don't know. I don't know if that works, or if that's something that you've seen work or fail personally, Sean, but I have that in the back of my mind as something they might do.
Yeah. I mean, there's some guys that have that mentality. Like Gagne was clearly one of them. John Smoltz, you know, even though he was had a long career as a starter before he became a closer. I think some guys just have trouble, switching because they like the routine of being a starter and on the schedule of when you throw and when you're completely off, and it's hard for them to get hot each night, or, you know, 3 out of 4 nights or whatever it is. So that, I think that's a question. You don't want to burn a young guy out if there's any risk to that based on his history, if he has trouble getting loose. So I think there's more to evaluate there, but I like what you're thinking. I mean, it's definitely a possibility. And what's hard, though, is let's say he's the closer to start the season, and for the first couple of months he's doing well, but then all of a sudden they'll say, you need a new starter because someone gets hurt, which inevitably happens. It's really hard to stretch him back out if he's your next best option as a starter. So that would take quite a bit of time to get from one inning to, you know, to five or six innings. So I think that's tricky. As a top prospect, sometimes it'll be someone that is throws really hard and is kind of a, you know, maybe a top 10 prospect, but not your number one guy. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of convert and like say, wait, this guy is throwing 3 to 4 miles an hour harder as a closer. And they switch him maybe a little prematurely before they've tried him as a starter. And I think that could be successful as well.
Yeah. Interesting development there to see what happens. I think the more exciting offseason of any, the most exciting offseason of any of the Southern California teams probably was in San Diego, where Xander Bogaerts recently signed an 11-year contract and giving the Padres probably enough shortstops to field an entire team based entirely on shortstops. Of course, Fernando Tatis Jr., if he's healthy, is expected back in 2023. Won't be playing shortstop, though. That goes to the man with the 11-year contract. And the Padres have had a pretty good offseason so far. And I look back at the standings from last season. The Dodgers won the National League West by 22 games. And, you know, they've lost more players to other organizations than they've acquired. And I just wonder if fans should be nervous. The 22 games wasn't enough to feel good going into 2023.
Yeah, you know, it's a very different team. And you know, the Padres have the momentum of the playoffs of beating the Dodgers. And, you know, adding Bogaerts is a great move. It's not necessarily what I would have done with that money if I'd always, you know, I think they have a lot in their lineup. They have already had a good lineup, and with Tatis coming back, it's even better than it was last year. And I would have added a starting pitcher or even some bullpen help, but you're never going to complain having a guy like Bogaerts in your lineup. He's such a pro. He's won. He's steady defensively. I mean, he's a great, great guy to have on that team. So they're a lot better. And the Dodgers, I wouldn't say they're going into the season a better team than they were last year. I think it's that'd be a kind of a tough argument because they were so good and they did lose, yeah, you know, some key bases. But, you know, I think the division is going to be tighter. And I don't know. I wouldn't. I think the Dodgers are still the favorite to win the division, but I think it's really close. And yeah, it'll be good. I think it's better for the Dodgers in the postseason. Kind of as we've seen, you know, they haven't been able, other than the one World Series championship, they've kind of gone in there oftentimes with, you know, without much to play for in September. And I think that's maybe hurt them a little bit in the postseason. So it's not a bad thing to have to fight your way into the postseason and kind of have that mentality and that scrappiness, for several weeks leading into the playoffs. And that's, I think what we could all hope for as Dodger fans is that they win the division, but it's tight and they have to earn it. And then I think the postseason gets, you know, all that, it just stretches it out longer. And I think it helps their chances.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's a 111 win team in the National League West residing anywhere this season, at least as of today. Not the Dodgers, not the Padres. I will say, to the Padres' credit, they did make an offer to Trey Turner. They threw their hat in the Aaron Judge ring. And for some reason, both of those guys decided they did not want to live in San Diego for the next decade. I don't know what's up with that, Sean. I can't say the Padres didn't try.
Yeah, that's a nice place.
It's a really nice place.
Yeah, I mean, Judge is the one that you could see being a California guy, understanding how beautiful San Diego is and close to home and all that. Trey, it was pretty clear that he wanted to go to the East Coast. And, you know, that Phillies team's, they're going to be scary too. It's going to be a fun year. I think there's a lot of teams of, you know, Padres, Phillies, the Mets, they lost to Grom, but then they get Verlander. So, you know, I think a lot of teams are going to be, you know, pretty close talent wise. So, and the Dodgers are right there. So it's easy to say what the Dodgers have lost, but, you know, let's be honest, over the last few years, they had, you know, just just a ridiculous amount of all-stars almost at every position. So to be able to bring up some young talent, we'll see what happens with their young stars. I think that could be, you know, a real game changer with Vargas and Miller in particular, but there's others as well. And that's how you continue the dynasties. You have to keep bringing up studs from your farm system, and the Dodgers have done that, and I think they're going to continue to do that.
I agree. They've got the best first baseman in the National League. They've got the best right fielder in the National League. I don't think that's too controversial. And they have four of the five starting pitchers from the best rotation in the National League coming back. So I think that's a foundation that any team would take. Still could add around the edges, but I think that's where you're looking at this point. Who knows? Like I said, about 6 weeks to go here before the start of spring training. Actually, less than that. We got a World Baseball Classic this year. So that'll be fun. That'll be something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's right.
But all things that we can talk about in the future. I'm looking forward to 2023, and this was a great way to kick it off. So thanks for joining me, Sean, as always.
Yeah, enjoyed it, and looking forward to getting spring training going sooner than later.
All right. Thank you to Sean Green for joining me on the podcast once again. Apologies to Paul Goldschmidt, reigning National League MVP and a pretty good first baseman. I suppose you could make an argument for him as the best first baseman in the National League. If you have not done so, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. All of those things help keep me going. In the meantime, stay dry, be well.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.